The world and everything in it is made possible in part by Compassion International. Compassion has been releasing children from poverty in Jesus' name since 1952. Learn more about sponsoring a child at compassion.com/world.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 6, 2017, and this is The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Joseph Slife. Ahead on our Monday legal docket, a case testing the limits of Native American tribal authority.
Every tribe passes this. Indemnify everybody. Nobody can sue you. So therefore, the tribe is totally immune from the most ordinary accidents taking place off the reservation, and there's no remedy at all.
Plus, Emily Witten will be here with World Radio's Classic Book of the Month for February. First, Jim Henry has a roundup of today's top news.
Protests against President Trump's travel ban continued in cities across the U.S. and Europe over the weekend. That despite court actions lifting the ban. On Friday, a federal judge in Seattle blocked the travel ban. Then yesterday, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco denied a Justice Department request to reinstate the temporary ban. So today, travelers with visas from the 7 Middle Eastern and African nations named in the executive order are free to enter the U.S. again. Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar told ABC's This Week the executive order was poorly executed.
When you put out an order that you have not worked with businesses or with your professionals in the security area when you've done it, I don't think it's a surprise there's going to be court challenges or that you're going to have chaos.
But Texas Republican Congressman Pete Sessions said the president is only using his executive powers to protect the country.
He has the authority based upon the United States Congress and the previous administration. This court is simply political, and this is why we needed Donald Trump to fix the courts.
The administration is expected to go before the appeals court again today, asking that the travel ban be reinstated. Iran carried out military exercises to test its missile systems over the weekend in apparent defiance of new sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. Those sanctions were a response to Iran conducting a ballistic missile test last week in violation of a UN resolution. And the president is now getting bipartisan support for his tougher stance on Iran. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein said Iran's missile program is troubling.
I think he is right in this. I think Iran is wrong in this. These are not nuclear ballistic missiles. They are not conventional ballistic missiles, but Iran has a lot of them, more than anybody else in that area. And the need to test right now, I think, is very dangerous.
House Speaker Paul Ryan told NBC's Meet the Press that the Iranian regime is increasingly hostile.
Look at what they're doing to finance terrorism, their human rights abuses, testing ballistic missiles. You see, they write on the side of their ballistic missiles in Hebrew, Farsi, and English, death to Israel and death to America. This is not a peaceful nation.
And President Trump weighing in with a tweet, quoting now, "Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how kind President Obama was to them, not me," unquote. And more strong words from Vice President Pence on the upcoming confirmation vote of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
"We will work with the Senate leadership to ensure that Judge Gorsuch gets an up or down vote on the Senate floor one way or the other."
Speaking to the Federalist Society in Philadelphia over the weekend, the vice president said Gorsuch is eminently qualified to serve on the Supreme Court and that he would be confirmed. He also warned Democrats that attempts to deny Gorsuch a confirmation vote will fail.
"Never before in the history of our country has an associate justice nominee to the Supreme Court faced a successful filibuster. And Judge Neil M. Gorsuch should not be the first."
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has also pledged that Gorsuch will be confirmed, raising speculation that Republicans could invoke the so-called nuclear option. That would mean suspending the Senate rule requiring 60 votes and instead confirming Gorsuch with a simple majority of 51. Republicans hold 52 seats in the Senate. President Trump sat down for a pre-Super Bowl interview yesterday with Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. World Radio's chief political correspondent Kent Covington has more.
The president on Sunday sounded off on a number of topics and top priorities for his administration, including replacing Obamacare. The president said replacing the program won't happen overnight, but it will happen.
It's statutorily takes a while to get. We're going to be putting it in fairly soon. I think that, yes, I would like to say by the end of the year, at least the rudiments, but we should have something within the year and the following year.
The president also slammed the ongoing push in California to turn that state into a sanctuary state. And he said his administration will use the federal purse strings as leverage.
I think it's ridiculous, sanctuary cities. As you know, I'm very much opposed to sanctuary cities. They breed crime. There's a lot of problems. If we have to, we'll defund.
He also caused quite a stir when asked if he respects Vladimir Putin. President Trump responded that he does respect the Russian president, and he added,
"Will I get along with him? I have no idea. It's very
possible. He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? Do you think our country's so innocent?"
That comment has sparked controversy with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle condemning the president's remarks. I'm Kent Covington.
Out of the shotgun, Ryan gets hit. This is a fumble. New England has it. Hightower knocked it out. And Branch recovers for the Patriots.
Fox Sports coverage of the NFL's Super Bowl 51. The New England Patriots overcame a 25-point deficit to defeat the Atlanta Falcons 34-28 in overtime last night, the first overtime game in Super Bowl history. It marked the largest comeback in Super Bowl history, with quarterback Tom Brady winning his fifth Super Bowl, also an NFL record. M. Night Shyamalan's Split stayed on top at the box office over the weekend, the PG-13 thriller edging out the competition with $14.5 million in ticket sales, but nipping at its heels, the horror reboot Rings.
"You've opened up a door, and now no one is safe."
PG-13 rated Rings, debuting in second place and bringing in $13 million, and a little friendlier fare in third place, PG rated A Dog's Purpose, with just under $11 million in ticket sales this weekend. You'll find World's reviews of current films, along with ratings and content information, at wng.org/movies. Straight ahead, a car wreck tests the limit of Native American sovereignty, plus our classic book of the month. This is The World and Everything in It.
Salt brings out the flavor. And when it comes to reporting the news, World tries to be salt, not sugar. You see, we're not here to be sticky sweet, but to stand for factual accuracy and biblical objectivity. Because we believe in a God who tells the truth and wants us to do the same. We're tough-minded but warm-hearted when presenting the news that matters to you. Going beyond the breaking news of the day to talk about culture, history, religion, and technology. World, bringing out all the flavors of God's world.
Good morning. You're listening to The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. It is Monday morning, February 6, 2017. I'm Nick Eicher. If the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court follows historic norms, he will miss out on a highly controversial case. On Friday last week, the High Court scheduled oral arguments on a case involving a transgender student and the use of public high school restrooms. Argument at the Supreme Court is set for March 28th. But Gorsuch is not likely to be seated on the court until at the earliest, the first or second week of April, if history is a guide. It takes on average 67 days from nomination to confirmation, and that's been the norm now for more than four decades. For example, President Obama's two Supreme Court justices won confirmation in 66 days and 87 days. 66 days for Justice Sonia Sotomayor, 87 days for Justice Elena Kagan.
His third nominee didn't make it at all, and Gorsuch is the replacement. But unless Gorsuch is seated in time for argument in this possibly landmark case, he will not take part in the opinion. Because of the vacancy on the court, that leaves open the possibility of a 4-4 tie and lack of clarity across the country. Here is what this case is all about. It involves the Gloucester County, Virginia Public School District and a transgender student, a biological female who demanded use of the boys' bathrooms and locker rooms. When the Obama administration last year reinterpreted sex discrimination law, a federal appeals court cited that reinterpretation and upheld the student's demand. The federal law known as Title IX bans sex discrimination in education. But the administration expanded the legal term sex to mean gender identity as determined by any individual. So if a girl decides that she's a boy, a school would be discriminating against her if it kept her out of boys-only facilities and programs, which is what the high school in Virginia did. Now, here is why the timing of Gorsuch's confirmation matters so much. Because 8 justices, not 9, would hear the case, the result could be a tie. In that event, a tie vote at the Supreme Court would leave the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court decision intact. That would mean that school districts in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland would have to abide by it, but it would not create a national precedent and would likely result in a rehearing of a similar case involving similar facts some years down the line. Well, on this week's Legal Docket, 2 oral arguments today. The first case revolves around a car accident. That's not your typical Supreme Court fact scenario, but neither is this a run-of-the-mill fender bender. This one has a connection to a Native American Indian tribe. And as a result, issues of sovereignty enter in. That's because of the unique legal status that American Indians have in the United States. Tribal administration predates the Constitution, and tribes are considered sovereign entities, countries within a country in many ways. We are still working out what those many ways mean, and here now to analyze the oral arguments in this case is World Radio Legal Affairs correspondent Mary Reichard.
This is not the case of Lewis and Clark, but the case of Lewis versus Clark. In 2011, William Clark was a limousine driver. Clark worked for the Mohegan Indian Tribe's casino operations in Connecticut. His job was to ferry gambling patrons to and from the casino. One night in October, Clark's limousine rear-ended another car on Interstate 95. Clark was taking some casino guests home, and he was near the town of Norwalk when he slammed into a car carrying a young married couple, Brian and Michelle Lewis. The Lewises suffered serious injuries, so they sued driver Clark for their extensive damages. But the Connecticut Supreme Court turned down their case, and not necessarily because the case lacked merit. It was that the Mohegan Indian Tribe has sovereign immunity from lawsuits like this, and specifically, that any employee of the tribe would be shielded from litigation as a result. Remember, the tribe operated the casino, and Clark was an employee. It didn't matter that Brian and Michelle Lewis had never been to the casino, nor did it matter that they were on an interstate highway and not on the Indian reservation at the time of the accident. And it didn't matter that Clark, the driver, isn't a member of any Indian tribe. This didn't sit right with the Lewises, so they appealed their case to the U.S. Supreme Court. So in January, just a few weeks ago, their lawyer, Eric Miller, got right to the point, arguing his case before the justices.
This is a traffic accident on a public highway in Connecticut, and the victims of that accident, the petitioners, had a right under Connecticut law to get redress from the negligent party, and they had a right to go to a Connecticut court to seek that redress. But the tribe does not have the authority to reach out into the state of Connecticut and take away petitioners' state law right from them.
Longstanding precedent works against Miller here. Tribal authority over its employees is pretty much settled. But just a few terms ago, in another tribe-related case, the Supreme Court hinted that maybe, in certain situations where injured people had no other recourse, tribal immunity might be somewhat curtailed. Lawyer for the limo driver, Neil Kotyal, argued to head off that possibility. It's time to definitively state tribal authority extends to an employee like Clark. Whether you call it sovereign immunity or official immunity, no matter. But Justice Samuel Alito could see a perverse incentive lurking within that.
Why should a tribal employee driving a limo be entitled to official immunity? You say that the purpose of official immunity is to protect, quote, the fearless, vigorous, and effective administration of policies of government. But you want to encourage limo drivers on I-95 to be fearless in the way they drive?
Not a problem, Katyal responded. Besides, states have leverage to get tribes to concede some of their power. If tribes want to get gambling operations going, they'll have to deal with a few state demands in return. But Justice Alito spotted a rather obvious conflict.
The state of Connecticut has a very strong incentive to be solicitous of the interests of the Mohegan tribe because the state gets an enormous amount of revenue from this casino. Isn't that true?
Katyal steered the argument back to long-standing practice for sovereign entities.
Noted, the Mohegan tribe is asking for the same protections from suit that every other sovereign enjoys. If Clark were a federal employee, a foreign employee, or a Connecticut state one, this suit would be barred. There's no reason the rules should be different for tribes, and indeed...
Justice Stephen Breyer saw the catch-22 in that.
Okay, so how do we deal with this? Every tribe passes this. You say, great, indemnify everybody. You'll never have to pay, because as soon as you do that, nobody can sue you. And so, therefore, the tribe is totally immune from the most ordinary accidents taking place off the reservation. And the victim of now these missiles being sent out from the reservation, because they run over people, and there's no remedy at all. Now that seems to me pushing the notion of tribal sovereign immunity off the reservation into a place where there are just no remedies for victims at all. So now, what is the answer to that?
The answer to that is in our brief.
Katyal exactly explaining right. That this is no shell game to avoid doing the right thing. Tribes naturally want to retain their power, and a functioning court system is part of a functioning sovereign. They have support from dozens of other tribes and five states with Native American-run casino operations. But injured people hurt by tribal employees say it isn't fair to leave them without a remedy or force them to go before foreign tribunals, in this case Indian courts, to receive justice. Hard to predict, but I could see the justices limiting their ruling to only actions that happen off reservations or doing as the U.S. government wants, which is remand to decide the case on a doctrine other than sovereign immunity. My second case today will strike fear into wage earners whose bosses file for bankruptcy. A New Jersey trucking company owed millions in wages when it fired its 1,800 truck drivers and then filed for bankruptcy. Wages have priority over other sorts of claims under what's known as Chapter 11 in the Bankruptcy Code. That's the type of bankruptcy where certain debts are paid in certain proportions in a planned-out way. But in this case, a bankruptcy court allowed a different payout plan that completely cut the truck drivers out of the deal. Lesser priority claims were paid, and the truck drivers had no say in the agreement. Justice Stephen Breyer posed a scenario with the 19th century pirate Jean Lafitte, perhaps as proxy for the truck company. Listen to this exchange with the truck company's lawyer, the now uncomfortable Christopher Landau.
So now, a company finds, very surprisingly, that there, underneath the building, is John Lafitte's gold treasure. See? But there is somebody down there who has it. He says, give it to me, it's ours. He says, I'll give it to you, but I want you to use it to pay my friend, who happens to be my cousin, who's the 19th ranked creditor. Right. And as long as you give the majority to him, okay, then you can give the rest to the others. All right, now, that would seem to be a possibility, at least, from your argument in this case.
Landau countered, that isn't the case here, not really. Justice Breyer pressed him further.
So the question is, do you think Congress gave to the trustee, or to you, or to somebody else, the power to deviate with Jean Lafitte's gold? Or with this particular set of money, or any other set of money. It seems to me a dangerous principle to get into, But if you can tell me where that normally happens, I'm open to...
Well, it doesn't normally happen. I think that...
It's a fact that coming to an agreement outside of court is far cheaper and less time-consuming than a lengthy court process. But to workers who already put in their time and didn't get paid for it, that's small comfort. The legal question is whether a bankruptcy court can skirt the text and purpose of the bankruptcy code, which the lower courts in this case approved as a matter of discretion for bankruptcy judges. Whatever the ruling, this is a high-stakes case. Bankruptcy always hurts someone, so the least bad alternative is an alluring analysis tool. The circuit courts are split on the matter, so the Supreme Court's guidance could give some much-needed clarity to head off future problems. Ambiguity in money matters and in the law usually creates more trouble. On the Legal Docket for World Radio, I'm Mary Reichert.
My name is Jay Mbiro. I was born in Nairobi, Kenya. I grew up hungry, without clothes most of the time. And as a little boy, I went to the streets of Nairobi and I started begging for food and money. I went to prison at the age of 9. And I said, God, if you exist, please take me out of this prison. And when you get me out of prison, please get me out of poverty. Because poverty is going to bring me back to this place. And I remember taking the news home and telling my parents that I've been selected to be one of the kids who are going to join Compassion Center. And it is through Compassion International that I can now stand here and say that God actually had a plan for me. There's so much that I got from Compassion. And one of the things that I got from Compassion was love.
Allow God to work through you when you sponsor a child in poverty. To learn more, visit compassion.com/world.
It's the world and everything in it for the first Monday of the month. And this year on First Mondays, we're showcasing World Radio's Classic Book of the Month. Our book maven is Emily Witten. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Joseph. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. But I am ready for springtime. Don't like the cold. Okay, now last month we started the year with a devotional book, Faith's Checkbook by Charles Spurgeon, first published about 125 years ago. This month you have a book that's much more recent, but nonetheless is already considered a classic. And it's not a religious book, but something altogether different. Tell us about it.
I would love to do that, Joseph. Before I do, though, let's start with a question I'm sure that you think about on a daily basis. What is economics?
Well, now, Emily, this may surprise you, but I can remember all the way back to my economics class in high school. So I know that at least part of the answer has to do with scarcity or supply and demand.
Hey, that's not bad, Joseph. You're pretty warm, actually, with what I wanted to bring up. Let me make it into a true or false question.
Okay.
True or false, economics is the study of the use of scarce resources that have alternative uses.
Well, now, I'm going to say true, not only because I took economics in high school, but because I believe that's the definition given in Thomas Sowell's book, Basic Economics, which I think you have a copy of right there.
That's so insightful, Joseph. Yes, that's right. And for people like me who don't normally ponder the what is economics type of question, I'm really excited to recommend Dr. Sowell's book this month. Written back in 2000, Basic Economics is now in its fifth printing. And one reason for the book's success is that Sowell does a great job here making a complicated subject understandable. There's no calculus, no graphs, very little academic jargon. I'm not saying it's a simple book. Sowell will definitely make you think. Mm-hmm. But he explains the role of prices and how profits and losses work in a way that most people can understand. And I think that's partly due to his background. Which brings me to quiz question number two, Joseph.
Okay.
True or false? Dr. Thomas Sowell is a conservative author and syndicated newspaper columnist who grew up in Harlem in the 40s and 50s, graduated from Harvard as an avowed Marxist, only to be converted out of his Marxism due partly to the influence of Milton Friedman and other Chicago school economists.
Well, much of that is true, but I'll have to say false because I read our editor-in-chief Marvin Olasky's recent article in World Magazine in which he reported that Thomas Sowell recently retired from writing his newspaper column.
Oh, well, I'll have to have a conversation with Marvin about giving you test answers ahead of time. But yes, he did just retire. The reason I bring up his background, though, is that Sowell has impeccable credentials. He graduated from and taught at several top universities. But he comes from a background of poverty. He attended public schools in Harlem as a young man, worked in machine shops and in the Marines in his early adulthood. So unlike a lot of intellectuals, he knows how to talk to people outside of academia, and that background gives him a unique point of view on economics. Listen to this clip from a 2014 interview with Dr. Sowell by Peter Robinson of the Hoover Institution about how his personal experience of poverty first made Marx's writing appealing to him.
On some evenings, come home, instead of taking the subway, which was a nickel in those days, I would splurge and take the Fifth Avenue bus, which was 15 cents. We'd start out from 23rd Street and go all the way up Fifth Avenue past all the glittering places, and we would turn left at 57th Street and go out past more glittering places, including Carnegie Hall. And then we'd turn up Broadway and then out to Riverside Drive, and all the fancy stuff there. And then at 135th Street, we'd come in off a viaduct, and immediately there'd be the tenements. And of course, this is where I live. And I went, what is this? And Marx seemed to explain that.
But of course, Sowell went on to study under Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who championed free markets. And while Sowell wasn't converted by Friedman's classes alone, his faith in Marxism crumbled after one summer as a government employee. Sowell says he realized that his fellow employees really weren't that interested in helping other people, but rather they were interested in keeping their jobs.
I was concerned as to whether this law was beneficial or not beneficial to low-income people. They were concerned because this law was providing one-third of the income of the U.S. Department of Labor. And once you begin to see that the government agencies have their own self-interest, quite aside from whatever they're theoretically supposed to be doing.
So they were behaving precisely as Milton Friedman would have predicted. They were in pursuit of their own incentives.
That's right.
They were not trying to establish justice on the face of the earth. They were trying to hold on to pretty good jobs.
Yes.
By the way, I highly recommend the rest of that interview if you're new to Dr. Sowell and basic economics. Even if you don't plan to read the book, you can learn a lot just from listening to that interview. And I'll provide a link to the interview on my Twitter feed at Emily A. Witten today. I'll also provide a link for a free audiobook version of Basic Economics on YouTube. For now, though, I have one last quiz question for you, Joseph. Okay. True or false, Thomas Sowell writes from a Christian worldview?
Well, I would say that his views certainly align with some realities about human beings, but I'll have to say, Emily, I'm not sure about that one.
Well, for all the reading I've done about him recently, I actually don't know either. What I can say is that some of his views certainly parallel Christian ideas. For instance, he seems to see the world as fallen in some way, and he realizes that economic policies must work within a constrained view of reality and human nature. While liberals seem to think poverty is only caused by a lack of opportunity, racism, or other kinds of oppression, Sowell says differences in wealth often reflect geographical differences, cultural differences, and other limitations that naturally occur in the world. And too often, he says, government interventions intended to help people actually hold them back.
In the book that I'm writing now, I discover this is true not only in the United States. It's true in England. And the situation is wholly different. And yet, if you read the data, for example, from London, educational tests and so forth, you see that there, immigrants from Africa pass this test they have. I'm talking about low-income people now, mm-hmm. nearly 60% of the time. Native-born whites in the same low-income bracket pass this test 30% of the time. And it's the same thing. The foreign people come in, they haven't had generations of being steeped in the welfare state vision, the vision of grievances, victimology, and resentments, the idea that there are enemies out there dedicated to keeping you down. That's the message that's been pumped into the head of the white lower class in Britain. And that's the image that's been pumped into the black low-income people in the United States. And the results are the same in both cases.
So while I don't agree with everything Thomas Sowell says, his basic economics can help us think more deeply about economic issues. And go beyond sound bites about Obamacare or protectionist trade policies that you often hear in the news today.
Again, our World Radio Classic Book of the Month for February is Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell, subtitled A Common Sense Guide to the Economy. It's now in its fifth edition. And don't be put off by the title. It's easy to read, pretty entertaining, and you may be able to find it at your local library. Emily, thanks so much for the recommendation.
Oh, you're very welcome, Joseph.
Now, as Emily mentioned, she'll be posting other information about our Classic Book of the Month on Twitter. She's at Emily A. Witten. Witten is W-H-I-T-T-E-N, at Emily A. Witten on Twitter. Or you can just use the hashtag WRClassicBooks, WR for World Radio, hashtag WRClassicBooks.
If you have unlimited curiosity about the world, but limited time to keep up with the news and today's cultural issues, World Radio is the perfect companion, helping you integrate trustworthy news and information into your daily routine. In addition to The World and Everything in It Monday through Friday, use the World Radio app to catch Listening In each weekend as Warren Smith talks with today's thought leaders and newsmakers. Your on-the-go partner for wise insights and reliable reporting. World Radio. You'll know it when you hear it.
Next on The World and Everything in It, the World Radio History Book. Happenings from early February in years past. Paul Butler is our history guide.
We begin today with February 8th, 1587, 430 years ago, the beheading of Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary was the former Queen of Scotland. After being forced from the throne, she fled to England and attempted to restore Catholicism in that land, even plotting to assassinate Protestant Queen Elizabeth. At her execution, Mary wears a crimson dress, the liturgical color of martyrdom. The executioners seek her forgiveness before she kneels, and Mary reportedly responds kindly. A scene reenacted here from the 1971 BBC series Elizabeth R.
Even as thy arms, O Jesus, were spread here upon the cross, so receive me into thy arms of mercy. The end of Mary Stuart's troubles is now done.
Mary was the last legitimate heir of the Stuart line, and her cousin Elizabeth I, Queen of England, who signed the execution order, was the last heir of the Tudors. 15 years later, following the death of Queen Elizabeth, Mary's son, King James I, unites England and Scotland. Every British monarch since has been a descendant of James. Next, February 9th, 1825. The U.S. House of Representatives elects John Quincy Adams as the 6th President of the United States. During the 1824 election 2 months earlier, 4 candidates ran for office, but none received a majority of electoral votes. The 12th Amendment mandated that the presidential election would now fall to the House of Representatives, which would choose from the top 3 candidates, Senator Andrew Jackson, Secretary of State Quincy Adams, and Secretary of the Treasury William Crawford. The House chooses Adams on the first ballot. Jackson, who won more electoral votes and the popular vote, is outraged, claiming collusion and corruption. 4 years later, Andrew Jackson runs again, defeating Adams. John Quincy Adams goes on to serve 17 years in the House of Representatives and becomes a leading voice for the abolition of slavery. Historian Harlow Giles Unger wrote a biography from Adams' 10,000 pages of diaries.
In his life, he served under George Washington and alongside Abraham Lincoln in the House of Representatives. So his life spanned the dawn of the American Revolution and continued to the eve of the Civil War. He knew all of the great characters during that period. And he speaks of them, writes about them, and tells of his life with them in this wonderful diary.
And finally, February 9th, 1941. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill delivers one of his most celebrated speeches of the war, addressing his countrymen, British forces, and allies around the world.
Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt
Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
1 month later, the U.S. Congress responds with the Act to Promote the Defense of the United States, which supplies the Allied nations with food, oil, warships, and weaponry. Before the year is out, the U.S. officially enters the war following the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. That's this week's World Radio History Book. I'm Paul Butler.
We're so glad you could be with us today. That just about wraps up the program for this Monday. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio, which is made possible by our world members. Tell your friends about our complimentary 3-month trial membership. It'll give them full access to this program, along with World Digital and World Magazine, all at no charge and with no obligation for 3 full months. Just point them to getworldnow.com. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Joseph Slife. On tomorrow's program, some wonderful reminders about prayer from the 2017 National Prayer Breakfast. We hope you can join us for The World and Everything in It.